Session number 8939, Captain Ian Hamerton, Reel 11.
You mentioned that in the attack on the radar station at Dover, you were working with Royal Marine Commandos, and I think you said they were shattered. What did you mean by that?
That it was a walkover. They didn't even bother to put the helmets on. No, we shot them in, and that was that. The engineers blew up the bunkers, put beehive charges on the top, and whoomph, and that was that. They'd had, I think, one or two tough engagements before, and all the previous attacks on the radar station had come to grief, and they had been prepared for a rather sticky battle.
What sort of size of force did the Germans have in those bunkers?
Well, there were several hundred came out, I think between 200 and 300, I can't remember the number now.
About half a battalion.
Yes, something like that. But I mean, they weren't all fighting troops.
And how many commandos were involved in attacking it?
Oh, I couldn't tell you at the moment. It's probably in the book, but two or three companies. I don't know.
Did they impress you as being different in any way from other infantry that you'd seen?
I can't answer that question, really. Their name certainly did. The fact that they were commandos was something to us, anyway.
What sort of targets were you shooting at when you were firing in support of them?
Well, we were firing across at right angles to the main attack, and with the object of just keeping any gunners' heads down. So we were just firing as a what later became known as pepper pot. It's a mixture of later was a mixture of Bofors and heavy machine gun, just designed to keep everybody's heads down. But we were firing HE and Browning at anything we could see, and not necessarily anything we could see.
Could you see very much?
No. No. To be perfectly honest, the first time I actually saw German infantry fully in action on a battlefield was well through the Reichswald battle. You usually didn't see the enemy at all. You saw flashes, and you saw them coming out with their hands up. But to actually see somebody and aim a gun at him and fire at him, you didn't. At least we didn't.
What sort of range were you firing at on that
at Douvres? Oh, 100 yards or so.
So you're really close in.
Very
on the
close.
Bunkers.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we were able to make that much close approach. We found some photographs afterwards, German photographs, that the German gunners had with all their marked targets. Ranges marked on them, and in fact they had a pretty good field of view, but there were one or two places where one could get close, and we happened to pick that one.
Had it been picked for that reason, or
yes.
So you weren't just being lucky again?
No, I think we'd picked it.
Over what sort of distance did the infantry have to advance to actually go into the attack?
Several hundred yards.
Did you actually see them going in?
Yes, yeah. Some of them came in almost on the same line as we were. We were more or less stationary, and as they came in onto the target, obviously they came in at an angle to us, And then they passed us and we ceased fire.
How were they formed up for this?
Oh, in open formation. In several waves, in open formation.
What sort of speed were they moving at?
Normal walking speed. They didn't do a bayonet charge or anything like that.
Were the Germans actually shooting at them?
I don't think they were, no. I think they were all tucked in bed, or at least well out of sight.
Keeping their heads down.
I think the beehive charges had the desired effect.
What sort of German troops were they?
I don't know. Did
you see them at close quarters when they came out?
No, I didn't. No. Some of the squadron managed to get into the remains of the radar place and found some bottles of champers and things like that. But quite frankly, that was one thing that my troop and I never wanted to do. We never touched any German stuff at all. I remember finding somewhere in Normandy a cat of nine tails from a German dugout, and the smell usually put us off. They seem to have a very peculiar soap which had a very odd smell, which was we didn't like very much. But we didn't want to touch any German equipment. I know some people used to go memento hunting, but Colonel Plowden was saying how he rescued the flag of the German commandant at Le Havre. But we weren't interested.
What about food and things like that? Did they get their hands on any German rations?
I don't think anybody wanted the German rations. That young SS chap that we had, the only food he had on him was a very hard, small crust of black bread. And that's the sort of ration I saw on several other prisoners. Just a small bit of black bread, nothing else. I understand that they did go short of rations from time to time.
I think that after the attack at Douvres and then at Cher, the next big effort in which you involved was Goodwood.
Mm-hmm.
What happened during that operation?
Well, it's very open country to the east of Caen. Open rolling fields. We were sticking our necks out in an armoured salient with little cover on our left flank, and we were keeping a very watchful eye out there because the 21st Panzer country, that was.
Conrooks.
Yes. And again, we were in support and were held back until we were wanted. The Guards Armoured went in, had some very bitter fighting in Cagny and one or two of the other little villages, and it was just outside Cagny, several hundred yards, half a mile, that I was waiting with my troop well spread out because there were odd shells coming over, when some three-tonners arrived. And the officer in charge jumped out and came over to me, and his face broke out into a smile. And he said, "Thank God I found somebody I recognise." And it was Captain Lord Claude Hamilton, who had been at the RAC Tactical School at Brasenose College, Oxford, when I was on the same course. Our letters used to get mixed up. That's how we got to know each other. And I said, "What are you doing here with this lot?" He said, "They want some ammunition and petrol. Where are they?" So I said, "They're in there, in that lot, in Cagny." "Oh," he said, "I'd better take them in." I said, "What, those, with your lorries like that, Well, they want it. They've got to have it. And off he went.
He was their B echelon.
He was their B echelon. And he took them in. And he came out because he became the master of the Queen Mary's bedchamber after the war. But I always thought he was either a bit crackers or extremely brave. But that's really all we saw of the battle, except a bit later on, whether it was the same afternoon or the next day or what, we were still spread out, not only us, but B echelon vehicles of various kinds and other tanks, and some enemy aircraft came over, and they were flying hedgehopping, and we just didn't have time to get our anti-aircraft Brownings in action. I would dearly have loved to have used my .5 for that, but alas, shortly after that, round the other side of Kong, on the next operation, whatever it was, we were harboured in a valley under some high elm trees. Our self-propelled guns were firing over the top and occasionally clipping the top of the tree, but it attracted counter-battery fire, and several shells fell in our field. One of them landed on my tank. I was sitting inside on the gunner's seat writing some letters on my map case, which was on my knees. I was facing backwards, and I heard the whoosh, and there's a tree bang, and my cupola just started spinning. It had hit the .5, the shell. It had broken the lock on the cupola and sent it spinning. And I looked up and forward and up, and I could see bits of gun going up in the air. So what goes up comes down again. So I sat back tight, and bits of it thudded in. And it didn't touch me. It didn't even spill the bottle of ink. Again, my operator's gas cape was riddled, which he promised to take home and show what a narrow squeak he'd had when he was wearing it. Sadly, one of my crews was sheltering under their tank, fortunately dug in. A shell burst alongside the tank in the direction that they were, but instead of bursting forwards to where they were, it burst backwards, and it killed somebody under the tank the other side of the field. But that's wandered away from Goodwood. That's all I saw of Goodwood.
So you weren't actually
looking
forward to flying or give support for Goodwood?
No.
And then after Goodwood, I think you got involved in Totalize.
Yes. We were whipped. We'd been round on, again, on the western side of Kong on that push that tried to get right down to the Odon. And we did get quite away. And then we were suddenly called back again by night. We came back. Whether we came through Kong or round Kong or what, I cannot remember, but we came into a factory area, I suppose it was Vercel. And the next night, I think, we were told all about this big do that was going to take place. I don't know that we're particularly happy or unhappy about the prospect, because the propaganda about the air assault was terrific, and they were going to bomb with thousands of bombers, and all the guns in the beachhead were going to be firing, and so on. Yeah, it worked very well, except that they made such a dust and smoke that visibility was nil, as I've already said. Of course, that was the next morning after that. There were a lot of tanks brewed up by Panzerfaust in that night attack, and that lit up the battlefield no end. I always felt sorry for the navigating officer who was in front of everybody in a tank. He couldn't keep direction either because of the smoke and so on. And that's, I believe he was helped by the Bofors and so on. But several tanks were brewed up and lit the whole place up. So, personally, I didn't get any further forward than that the next day because the tank was out of action and the rest of my troop were well on ahead. And they were up on the ridge ready to support the poles when they went in. And if you remember, the American Air Force bombed our gun lines instead of the 88, and Kurt Meyer had withdrawn his 88s back from where they were supposed to be and then put them forward again. And the Poles ran smack onto them with terrible casualties. I've always felt very sorry for the Poles. They got it in the neck everywhere.
Did you see a lot of the Poles in Normandy?
Not a lot, no. That was the first time they'd been in action that day, and they were raring to go. No, that we didn't see much of them after that. Not from my squadron, because, as I say, we were in reserve after that at St. Aignan, when they were further forward with the A and C squadron, I think, went forward with them.
When your tank was temporarily disabled, and the track was broken and so forth, how did you sort that out? Did you do it, or did a recovery vehicle or the LAD come up? And
the LAD had to haul us out. Normally, if it was broken on a mine, we could usually do it ourselves, because we always carried spare track plates. But we were in this wretched crater, and I don't think we got it. I think the LAD came and did it.
How quick were the LAD if you put out a distress call?
Oh, they'd come up pretty quickly. I'm trying to think of an occasion. I tell you when they were snookered, and that was after the Siegfried Line assault, when the ground was so soft that even the Guards Armoured Brigade Churchill recovery vehicles were the only things that would get us out. It took us a whole day to move the squadron through one field. It was terrible. But that's sort of jumping ahead a bit, isn't it?
When the LAD were called out, was there standard practice to deal with repairs on the spot, or did they prefer to take the vehicle back and
If it was something that they could deal with on the spot, they did. If it was required workshop facilities, obviously they'd have to pull back a bit.
I think you also mentioned the attack on Le Havre. That presumably came later after the fall of Caen.
Yes.
Did you actually go into Caen after it had been taken?
I think we must have gone through it. Yes, I did. I can't remember very much about it, except that it was in ruins.
Did you see anything of the inhabitants?
No. While we were in... When we were pulled out to have our engines changed after Falaise, I think we went in a lorry up into Caen one day, but there was just nothing. So we came back again. And then we all went down with this wretched dysentery and we weren't inclined to go anywhere except to the loo.
How did they deal with that outbreak, dysentery?
I can't remember. I suppose we all got dosed up with something or other. The MO.
Apart from that occasion, what was your general state of health?
Oh, marvellous. Although I was soaked, totally soaked on D-Day, through bailing out in the sea. I suppose I was wet, or my boots were the last thing to dry, 3 days later. No cold whatever. At Le Havre, after the battle, when we retired back to Buccleuch before moving on, in those German hutments where the water was all around us and a heavy rain, I got a stinking cold. And I'd made friends with the resistance leader, Monsieur Petit, who was about 6 foot six, and went down to his house most evenings, if I possibly could. And we shared our sardines and bully beef and haricot oxtail with them. And I went down there with this awful cold, and Yvonne, Madame Petit, made me have a hot drink of hot Calvados and sugar. And somehow or other I got back to camp that night, and we had to move at something like 3 o'clock in the morning, and my cold had vanished. It's incredible. I don't think I had a cold after that at all.
Did you ever get into the town of La Havre after your flailing around the edge of it?
No, we went straight back to we were after the night attack on the Sunday, when we broke through the defences. I was all set, and the next phase was to attack some heavy, very heavy gun positions in big concrete bunkers and goodness knows what. But fortunately it was called off because they surrendered. So I saved that one.
And what happened to you then? Were you involved in this great surge forward up to the
side? Well, the rest of the army had gone on, and they'd got almost to Antwerp, I think. So as General Hobart had promised us back in September 43 at Stow on the Mould, we were doing the clearing up of the channel ports. So that B Squadron wasn't involved with either Boulogne or either Dieppe, Boulogne or Calais. We did Le Havre, and I think it was the Lothians did one of the others. And our next one was the actual Scheldt outside Antwerp. There was a pocket of German resistance on the south bank. And that was a very unpleasant episode. We went on our tracks right across northern France into Belgium, got to the outside Ghent and to a little village called Samazek, and there we were told we were going to stay there for several weeks, and we were to start changing our tracks and bogey wheels as necessary, which we did. And we just got all the tracks off, and we said you were to move tomorrow morning. I hurriedly put them all back on again, and we moved forward by night, and we went up to a place called Philippine, and the Germans had flooded the area, and we had to drive along the dike roads in the dark with no lights, and the flood water came over the road surface, so all you could see were the trees on either side. And you just had to sort of steer a line in between. And at one point there was a Bailey Bridge put over a little stream, but the Bailey Bridge was underwater. And anyway, we got through, and we went to a place called Eisendijk and Schoendijk, where we lodged in some huge barns with lovely hay to sleep on, until the German guns from Walcheren, firing across the Scheldt, started setting these things on fire. And we gave that up. And there was also a rather nasty accident happened to the Avrys nearby in the next field. They were being reloaded with explosives and so on, and either a stray shell or something went adrift, and the whole lot blew up. And it was an enormous bang. and bits of tank and people flying about. Anyway, my troop had to flail up to Canadian positions near Breskens, and I had to flail along the top of a dike. I don't know whether I've mentioned this, have I? You've got it, so there's no need to repeat. Where we got covered in mud, and I slid off the top, sat the prisoners in the mud to bring them back. And then we were on call for the attack on Breskens. If I remember rightly, Monty used the buffaloes to take the enemy by surprise by coming in from the sea. And we were on the land side to shoot them in from the side. And that was, there was no problem there. Then we were brought back onto an airfield near, not far away. And I can remember that's when the British Army ABCA pamphlets were coming in, Army Bureau of Current Affairs, and there was the article about, I think, the Beveridge Report, or something like that, about how things were going to be after the war. So we had little discussions about that. And I remember in the middle of that, there was a huge fleet of fortresses flying over, ever so high, with their accompanying fighters, and we saw one fighter suddenly dive. You could hear the sound of the engine working up to a terrific whine, and then we saw a parachute blossom out, and this fighter continued absolutely vertical dive with the engine flat out, and it hit the ground a mile or so away, I suppose. A great flame shot up. It's quite exciting. And then we were brought near Antwerp, put on these transporters, and there was the episode of going through the tunnel, into Fort Schoten, one of the old Napoleonic forts, the other side. We were very pleased we were in there. That was a real safe place because the V2s were coming over and landing on Antwerp. And the first passion wagon we had in to Antwerp, which was still in pretty good nick, and the cinemas were showing and so on. The first one, as we got out of the passion wagon in the boulevard, a V2 fell right opposite. And we were all for going back straight away. Anyway, I think the next one fell on the cinema, which was full of people, 2,000 or 3,000 people killed. We decided it was not a very good place after that.
You say you were used to shoot troops in Breskens.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any real hard opposition there?
There had been considerable hard opposition. One little incident I remember was that after I'd flailed along that dike, one of